lodges I ride in this wind.
Like God, in whose image we are made, we speak worlds into existence. Why then does present-day language seem so impotent, so ineffectual? Why has talk become cheap? What has happened to that original language with its creative power? How has the creative breath devolved into the ubiquitous matrix of lies we find ourselves in today?
In the damp, foggy midnight, you snort my good pony, and you give me.
You're listening to episode 673 of Unwelcome Guests, The Language of the Vast Machine. I'm Robin Upton. And the vast machine, of course, is a David Graeber metaphor to describe the control system, the apparatus, the state, that part of humanity which is invested in perpetuating adherence to the hierarchy of domination and control, of repressing any ideas about alternative ways of living to the capitalist reductionist monoculture. And the language of the vast machine, I'm going to suggest, is in fact the ubiquitous matrix of lies, which we just heard Lynn Gehry introduce to us by reading from Charles Eisenstein's Ascent of Humanity. So this show, we're going to hear some of these threads of lies. We're going to pull them out of the tapestry and speculate a little on how they came to be. And we're not really going to tackle on exactly what to do about the tapestry of lies at this stage. Got that one for another show. But the first thing I suggest is to become really clear on what these lies are. Lie suggests deliberate deceit, but if the person who is spinning the lie themselves believes it to be true, does that make it any less of a lie? And since its earliest days, people have been complaining there's a lot of lies on the internet. Well, that's true, but is the internet any more or less prone to deception than, say, television or newsprint? With entire bureaucracies dedicated to promoting untruth that could be largely staffed by people who believe the untruths they're promoting, for example, that children need to be educated in economic literacy because that's a fundamental requirement for success and happiness in modern life. Where do we pin down the lies? Well, personal testimony, meeting somebody face to face who says, "This happened to me, I saw this," is less common than it used to be. A lot of people these days are watching screens and they're getting their information nth hand. So let's start the show with some personal testimony. This is an incident we've referred to on the show before, but we didn't listen to it. This is the testimony of Nurse Naira, testifying to Iraqi war crimes in the run-up to the vote about whether the Americans should attack Iraq in Kuwait. Now, Naira's testimony goes on for 4 minutes, but there's a couple more minutes from Representative John Porter, co-chair of the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. So have a think about his disposition. Is he perhaps part of the same Hill and Knowlton public relations campaign? Is he being coached on how to speak? Or do you think his apparently spontaneous outburst is in fact just that?
Our final witness is also using an assumed name, and again we ask our friends in the media to respect the need for her to protect her family. And we finally call on Naira to testify.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Naira, and I just came out of Kuwait.
My
My mother and I were in Kuwait on August 2nd for a peaceful summer holiday. My older sister had a baby on July 29th, and we wanted to spend some time in Kuwait with her. I only pray that none of my 10th grade classmates had a summer vacation like I did. I may have wished sometime that I could be an adult, that I could grow up quickly. What I saw happen to the children of Kuwait and to my country has changed my life forever. It has changed the life of all Kuwaitis, young and old. We are children no more. My sister, with my 5-day-old nephew, traveled across the desert to safety. There was no milk available for the baby in Kuwait. They barely escaped when their car was stuck in the desert sand, and help came from Saudi Arabia. I stayed behind and wanted to do something for my country. The second week after invasion, I volunteered at the Al Adan Hospital with 12 other women who wanted to help as well. I was the youngest volunteer. The other women were from 20 to 30 years old. While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor. It was horrifying. I could not help but think of my nephew, who, if born premature, might have died that day as well. After I left the hospital, some of my friends and I distributed flyers condemning the Iraqi invasion until we were warned we might be killed if the Iraqis saw us. The Iraqis have destroyed everything in Kuwait. They stripped the supermarkets of food, the pharmacies of medicine, the factories of medical supplies, ransacked our houses, and tortured neighbors and friends. I saw and talked to a friend of mine after his torture and release by the Iraqis. He is 22, but he looked as though he could have been an old man. The Iraqis dunked his head into a swimming pool until he almost drowned. They pulled out his fingernails and applied electric shock to sensitive private parts of his body. He was lucky to survive. If an Iraqi soldier was found dead in a neighborhood, they burned to the ground all the houses in the general vicinity and would not let firefighters come until only ash and rubble was left. The Iraqis were making fun of President Bush and verbally and physically abusing my family and me on our way out of Kuwait. We only did so because life in Kuwait became unbearable. They have forced us to hide, burn, or destroy everything identifying our country and our government. I want to emphasize that Kuwait is our mother and the Emir our father. We repeated this on the roofs of our houses in Kuwait until the Iraqis began shooting at us. And we shall repeat it again. I am glad I am 15, old enough to remember Kuwait before Saddam Hussein destroyed it, and young enough to rebuild it. Thank you.
Naira, thank you. Let me thank all of our witnesses. We've passed 8 years in the existence of the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. We've had scores of hearings about human rights abuses throughout the world. And I know my co-chairman, Tom Lantos, will join me in telling you that we have never heard in all this time, in all circumstances, a record of inhumanity and brutality and sadism as the ones that the witnesses have given us today. I don't know how the people of the civilized countries of this world can fail to do everything within their power to remove this scourge from the face of our earth. And the witnesses, by providing to us eyewitness accounts and reports detailing the conduct of the Iraqi soldiers under the command of Saddam Hussein have done a great service to their country and to ours and to all countries of the world who must join together and take whatever action may be necessary to free the people of Kuwait from this aggression and brutality.
Now, thanks to C-SPAN, we have a video recording of that exchange, and I've posted it on this show's webpage. I would love to hear what a body language expert had to say about John Porter's expression, because he looks pretty, well, deranged, I suppose is the word, by that testimony. Is that all part of the act? Or did he take that testimony, as a lot of people did, at face value? And what about all these people? Bush, for example, repeated that at least 10 times in the following few weeks, and it was all over the media. It is generally agreed to be the single most effective part of Hill and Knowlton's Citizens for a Free Kuwait campaign, designed to inspire the American war machine to move in. How many of the figures who echoed that in the media implicitly assumed that it was true? How many of them thought, well, it might probably be a lie, but we'll say it anyway? And how many of them didn't even bother to think whether it was true or not, but thought instead about whether their boss would be happy to hear it? I think a lot of this ubiquitous matrix of lies is not conscious deceit, or even unconscious deceit, but it's lack of thought. It's people who just echo things because they go through the motions. As we've heard from Jeff Schmitt's Disciplined Minds audiobook, very highly recommended if you're a newcomer to the show, professionals in the process of training are not only given knowledge, but are checked for attitude and are steered towards what Jeff Schmitt describes as assignable curiosity. They only ask questions where they're told to ask questions. They implicitly believe and go along with everything else. And in case there's any doubt, then there's an explicit requirement in the contract that they have to do things that the boss tells them to do. Now that, from one way of looking at it, that's the linchpin of hierarchical organization, and money is usually explicitly a part of that. That is a big part of what allows the matrix of deceit to function, in the same way that the vast machine produces hopelessness when it convinces people this is how it has to happen. There's no possibility of a real change. One might have thought, given that the person who testified was a member of the Kuwaiti royal family, daughter of the American ambassador, somebody would have recognized her and said, well, that's rather suspicious. And yet, at the time, nobody did. Well, I said I wasn't going to go too much into what to do about the ubiquitous matrix of lies, but that's the very first point, I guess, is to be aware that such audacious stunts do get pulled, and with some fairly simple checking, then they can also get uncovered. So, bearing that in mind, I was interested to find a page on a website which I recommend to you heartily, called wikispooks.com, I shall link it in from this show's webpage, about a woman referred to as Dr. Rola, appearing on BBC's Panorama news program. She is testifying on the show about a bomb which was dropped on a school and resulted in lots of terrible chemical injuries, suggestions of napalm, maybe. And the timing of this was in the run-up to votes on whether the UK should be sending in bombers to attack the Syrian government. So that got my curiosity. And then I found an article by a former speaker on unwelcome guests, an ambassador who was removed from the UK diplomatic service for his persistent questioning about glitches in the Matrix, Craig Murray. And what he said was, we have the same video with different audio. They've messed it up. The BBC has edited the audio from Dr. Rolla without telling us. So let's listen to the first audio section, purporting to be a live report of casualties coming in to hospital after a chemical weapons attack in Syria. The woman whose voice you hear is identified as Dr. Rolla.
It's just absolute chaos and carnage here. We've had a massive influx of what looked like serious burns. It seems like it must be some sort of, I'm not really sure, maybe napalm, something similar to that.
And that was as broadcast on the 26th of August. Now let's hear from Dr. Rolla on the 30th of September.
It's just absolute chaos and carnage here. We've had a massive influx of what looked like serious burns. It seems like it must be some sort of chemical weapon. I'm not really sure.
So did you catch the difference? Well, let's play both recordings simultaneously.
It's just absolute chaos and carnage here. We've had a massive influx of what looked like serious burns. It seems like it must be some sort of
something similar to that. So two recordings, only one mention of napalm. Now, the first 11 seconds, the words, the intonation, the pattern of background noises are so similar that I believe the two were created from software. One had some noise cancellation. It's inconceivable to me, after years of editing audio, that somebody could say something that similar. Never mind somebody who is in an emergency situation. Dr. Rolla is conveniently wearing a surgical mask, so we can't tell whether those words were what she said on either of the two, but we know it couldn't have been both. So, point number one. The BBC are editing audio tracks and not telling us. What you hear does not necessarily match what people said. I went back to Craig Murray's blog, researching further, and the next day discovered some eagle-eyed viewers had detected the two video streams were not identical. Now, they'd been cut, obviously, but it wasn't a matter of cutting. The same people were in the same places relative to one another, but although very similar, they were not identical. On one of the videos, there's a guy in a yellow fluorescent jacket, has his left hand down by his side. On the other video, it's held behind his back. So this is not a matter of a camera angle. People are in the same positions, but they are different. There's a few more differences. There's a car is present in one and absent in another. There's a guy behind a wall. You can see him in one, his head sticking right above it, but the other one is not. So, undeniably, this apparently live report has been done in multiple takes. Well, how did they do that? If these are people being rushed to hospital, did they rush them into the hospital, out of the hospital again, and into the hospital again? Do we really supposed to believe that if, considering they claimed the hospital was overrun with casualties, the medical staff were persuaded to arrange multiple takes for the BBC? It's quite undeniable if you watch the video, and I've just posted two short sections of video to the Unwelcome Guests website. So if the BBC has any credibility left in your eyes, then I would encourage you to watch those two videos and check for yourself that what is presented as live action is in fact definitely not. And also watch the rest of the video. It has several other issues which are analysed in detail by a lot of commentators. There's some good people at Global Research analyzing this. But watch the video, because it's good to have a visual fix on these lies. There's a lot of people out there who haven't yet understood what the BBC is. And now we're going to hear a short video from RT, which I found on YouTube. This was published on October the 10th, 2012. So this is not about the current run-up to the war on Syria, but this is also about the difficulty of establishing the truth and the routine nature with which video reports from the Middle East are faked.
Our top story now. Syria's turmoil has been laid bare on our TV screens for more than a year. But some networks are being accused of affecting rather than reflecting the conflict. Mira Fonoshna reports now on how there's more to the coverage on the Qatari-owned Al Jazeera TV channel than meets the eye.
Clashes in the streets of Syria have been raging for a year now. But behind the scenes, there is a media war that's just as damaging as the one taking Syrian lives. Rafiq Lotf, freelance investigative journalist from Damascus, says he's found what he thinks is proof of media manipulation of the conflict in Syria. In this video from the Syrian town of Homs, the camera focuses on the city's oil refinery. The shooting begins 7 hours before media viewers around the world see a pipeline explosion allegedly caused by Assad's army bombardment. You can clearly see that something is slowly burning in the distance. When the smoke has thickened, English speakers correct the camera's position for a better shot of what's going on. They shake it to make it look like amateur video.
I know this video is on the Al Jazeera server. It's clear it's not an explosion, but they ignore that and keep on reporting it the way they need to see it.
In another video from a hospital in Homs, someone behind camera talks to a doctor. In the corner, we see little Nakham.
When you are on air, you should tell Bashar God will punish you and then talk about his wife, okay? Let's rehearsal again.
After some 30 minutes of waiting, the crew starts to get nervous.
Let's call Al Arabiya, maybe. For how long can we wait?
No, we need Al Jazeera.
While live on Al Jazeera eventually, the girl will forget some details.
God punish you, Bashar, and your children.
In this footage, we see Danny, a Homs activist known for his exclusive reports from the very epicenter of the conflict. He's preparing to go live on CNN, and there is no shooting until he asks for it.
What shall I say?
Tell them there are some buildings collapsed, and we're taking bodies away.
You say there could be as many as 200 dead just in the last hour or two?
We have 200 dead in the last 3 hours. In the first half an hour, we've got 40 dead. In the first half an hour, and we got the video up on YouTube.
The activists who become journalists try to make their shows as hard as possible. The more blood and death, the higher the price.
But not everyone is happy about it. Well-known war correspondent Ali Hashem used to report for Al Jazeera from the world's conflict hotspots, but Syria has become the Rubicon he couldn't cross. He mentioned armed groups fighting against Assad's army, and his bosses in Doha told him he needed a vacation. Ali has just resigned because of biased coverage, he says.
Some were like, promoting the revolutions in Libya, Syria, Egypt, Tunisia, whatever, and dumping, for example, the revolution in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia.
The Al Jazeera chief in Beirut, where Ali has been working, has also quit for same reason.
We started to invite guests from America who only criticize the regime in Syria and support the regime in Bahrain, and persons who justify NATO intervention. This is unacceptable.
The media in this is just a proxy. It's a proxy used by external factors, by external factions, by external governments, by maybe the West, whoever, to fuel this wars.
With more and more proof emerging of the international media's involvement in the Arab Spring revolutions, the question remains open: to what extent do they influence events, and how much responsibility do they therefore share for what follows? Marie Fnoshina, RT, Beirut, Lebanon.
And I haven't investigated the particular deceptions referred to in that video, but in the context in which I present them, they do appear to me to be all too credible. And that's not to say RT is devoid of its own deceptions. All the commercially controlled media, by my definition, can be controlled from the top through big money. So if they do voice opinions unwelcome to big money, that would be because of some glitch in their ubiquitous matrix of lies. That is, of course, not the official narrative. That's my interpretation. The official story about the ubiquitous matrix of lies is a kind of a meta-lie, if you like, a lie about lies. It says that machinery is in place, legal statutes, precedents, and bureaucracy exists to prevent lies and to detect them. And if lies occur, then they can be corrected. Well, that in itself, of course, is a lie, because it would just be too inconvenient these days, with the amount of lying that goes on, if there was any kind of sincere effort to hold up the public expectation that liars can be held to account. And unless you've been asleep at the wheel, that is, unless you've been plugged into commercially controlled media, you won't have missed this. We're going to go back 12 and a bit years to episode number 12 of Unwelcome Guests, and hear the end of an interview with Steve Wilson and Jane Acree, two reporters who at that time were suing Fox after they were fired for refusing to lie on air about the safety of Monsanto's products. We pick up with Steve Wilson explaining how, in his opinion, the commercially controlled media were in fact controlled from the very top.
We were about to broadcast this on one of 24 television stations that Fox owns. There's a Fox Network, which runs the Fox News Channel and the network news operation out of New York, and then there's a separate division in Rupert Murdoch's empire called the Fox Television Stations. And those are 24 television stations, including the one we were assigned to work at in Tampa, Florida. He owns more television stations, I might point out, than any other individual or company in America, 24 of them. And what happened was, this was the station where we were about to broadcast it, but when the pressure from Monsanto came, it went right to Roger Ailes, who technically had nothing to do with it, but whatever they said to Mr. Ailes, he certainly had the clout to pass the word down.
Well, certainly that seems to be the case. I mean, this story is bad enough simply if one were to hear that Fox killed a story that possibly a big corporate entity was upset about. But we do hear about that. That does happen, and unfortunately it happens more and more in American media today. But there's more to this story than simply Fox just killing the story, isn't there?
Yes, and to say that that we filed this breach of contract suit because they killed a story would just be erroneous, because reporters get stories killed all the time. I mean, that's just the way it is. Management has the right to decide which battles they want to fight. And we may not like it, we might complain about it, but, you know, they really do have that right. What they don't have the right to do, though, is to take a story and to fine-tune it and to make it more palatable for their own self-interest. And by that, I mean slanting or distorting the news so that it has more of a Monsanto angle to it. I mean, at one point, our managers were reading directly out of Monsanto-generated literature and telling us, put that in your story, without being able to refute it. And that is what we feel is the basis of our lawsuit, and that is what we feel a television station does not have the right to do.
I just want to go back just to clarify what you said, and that was that people in authority at the station were literally taking what could, I guess, be called Monsanto press release material and information and instructing you to put that in your story and have nothing to counterbalance them.
Yes.
Was that all they did? I mean, that's bad enough. I mean, I'm just wondering, is there more?
No, that is not all they did. We had a couple of reputable scientists who were very adamant critics of the use of this drug. And, I mean, one of them has three medical degrees and is a professor at the University of Illinois and has written 8 books on the environmental causes of cancer. And we had to reduce him instead of putting his credentials in there, which we felt was important, because this isn't just another cancer scare guy from who knows where. I mean, this is a guy who's who has a background in this area. This is what his area of expertise is. And we had to reduce him down to a scientist in Chicago. We had to take out reputable, well-credentialed, anything like that that would help explain and put him in context. We also had a fellow in Wisconsin who has developed agricultural chemicals for 30 years, and we had to reduce his credentials down to a scientist in Wisconsin. Now, you know, who is this guy? As a viewer, I want to know, is this guy credible? But we really couldn't tell you that. And there were other things that they did as well.
Talk about what those were.
Well, you know, it was as basic as saying things that were just demonstrably untrue. I mean, it's one thing, and everybody sort of expects that a company, and any company does this, they want to put the most favorable spin, the most favorable interpretation on any kind of a story that they don't like. And that's certainly understandable. But this, as you point out, it went way beyond trying to put their industry-friendly spin. It was telling us to broadcast and to allow them to say without any contradiction facts that we knew to be false. There are so many of them, I know we don't have the time to go into, but let me just give you one example of the most basic fact of all that we just said, we will never do this because it's wrong. They wanted the report to convey to the viewer that there is no difference between a glass of milk from a cow that was treated with this artificial hormone and a cow that had not had the injections of bovine growth hormone. They wanted us to give the viewer the impression by letting Monsanto say there's no difference in the milk. Now, there is a difference in the milk, and it's an important difference in the milk. Levels of a chemical called IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor, which is a known promoter of cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer, the levels of IGF-1 are much higher and more potent in the milk from a cow injected with artificial hormone than in the milk from a cow that has had no hormone injections. Now, you can argue that the levels aren't significant. You can argue that, yeah, they're higher, but it won't really hurt you. You can put whatever spin on that you want to, but it is wrong, it's misleading, it's inaccurate, it's unfair to say to the viewer and let the viewer walk away from the broadcast thinking there's really no difference in the milk. That is a perfect example of the kinds of inaccuracies and distortions that they insisted we do.
Fox executives and people in authority at the television station and at the network instructed them, from what I'm hearing you both say, to change the story to make it more favorable to Monsanto Corporation. Does that reasonably sum up what we're discussing here right now?
That's exactly the claim in our lawsuit, that we were ordered to lie, to mislead, to slant, to distort the story, to distort what we knew to be the truth, what we had documented and shown the Fox television people to be the truth. And, you know, as you point out and as Jane has said, stories are killed from time to time. It's happened since the first newspaper was ever printed, I'm sure. Whenever the newspaper owner or the broadcaster's personal interest or that of his friends or his advertisers get to be more important than the public interest, stories get killed. It's wrong. It shouldn't happen, but it does. And as Jane points out, you know, the freedom of the press belongs to those who actually own the press. And it's their right to decide what stories they want to cover. But when they start telling reporters, we're going to go beyond just not letting you tell a story, we're going to tell you to tell the story in a dishonest and inappropriate and inaccurate and distorted way, you've got to stand up as a reporter and say, wait a minute, that crosses the line, we're not going to do it. And that's what this suit is about.
I mean, we're talking about something, as best as I can understand it, and not in any way, shape, or form pretending to be an expert on bovine growth hormone. But, I mean, it sounds to me that this stuff is potentially dangerous. I mean, potentially very dangerous. And being used, people are making promises that they're not selling products containing bovine growth hormone, and yet they are. You've uncovered this. There are medical and chemical factors regarding bovine growth hormone that make it potentially very dangerous. And here's a major network, news network, television network, trying to cover that story up.
Yeah, I think you make a very important point, and that's one of the reasons we find ourselves suing our former employer. I think if this was a story about, and you run into stories like this all the time, maybe a con man out there who was had gotten 10 people to invest money, and he ripped them all off, and he ran away with their money. I don't think we'd be here today, but this is a much more important story that has much far-reaching implications than one guy and 10 victims. I mean, milk is primarily consumed by children. And you also bring up an important point. We're not saying that BGH-treated milk causes cancer, because we're not experts and we're not scientists. We can't say that. But we think the public should know that there are public health questions, and some very well-credentialed scientists do believe that, indeed, this is leading to tumor promotion. And the public, at the very least, should have the option when they go to the grocery store of buying milk from treated or untreated cows.
What has happened to the material that you've provided to Fox, be it video or script, whatever you have gathered and garnered in your investigation on this story? Where is that material now?
Well, all of the material that we gathered, of course, we gathered while we were working there, and they had continuous, and still do, access to that material. And one of the interesting points is they said all along, and this is one of the points they're stressing now, they always thought this was an important story. It was a story that viewers ought to know about. It was a story that ought to be told. And yet, we fought for nearly a year to get it on the air in a fair and accurate way and couldn't get them to do it. But more importantly, they fired us on December the 2nd. On April the 2nd, we filed suit 4 months later, and now it's been a couple of weeks after that. What did they do between December the 2nd and today to tell this important story, to let their viewers know what the truth was? Even if they thought we were terrible reporters, and we both have more than 20 years of experience, and we have some rather prestigious awards, and we've been doing this for a while, and neither one of us has ever, you know, been sued and lost or had to give a retraction on the air. I don't think we're that terrible. But even if you buy their argument for a moment that these two reporters were just out of control and they didn't want to tell the truth, they fired us on December the 2nd. What did they do between then and now to get the story out with a reporter they could trust? They've been devoting their time and the efforts of their investigative unit and their resources to doing important investigations like trying to determine which local pizza parlor puts the least cheese on your pizza. They've done nothing. They've done nothing to tell the story to Floridians who were promised this wouldn't be in their milk, that their milk is now riddled with this at every major supermarket in the state. So the protest that they make now, that they believed it was a good story, but they just didn't trust us, that rings a little hollow.
Mm-hmm.
You have filed suit against Fox.
We have filed a breach of contract suit because we contend that they cannot fire us for illegal reasons. I'm trying to slant the news would be an illegal reason. And also we are looking for a status under whistleblower status in the state of Florida, which would afford us some protections. We should mention, and a couple of reporters have asked about this, you know, how much money do you hope to be awarded as a result of this? And this is not about money. Early on, about a year ago or so, or shortly after we began having problems, they offered us a buyout to pay our full year salary. The only thing we'd have to do for that, not to come to work, but just to keep our mouths shut about them and how they conduct their business and about the bovine growth hormone story. They just wanted us to go away. So if this was simply about collecting cash and sitting home by the pool, that you know, clearly doesn't ring true, because we could have cashed in a long time ago. If we do win any award under this whistleblower statute, and, you know, the award could go, you know, who knows how high it could go, but there are no limits on that, we are going to, after we recoup our legal expenses and the year's salary that we feel we deserve, we are going to donate it to a journalism foundation so that other reporters who find themselves in the position of choosing between telling the truth or feeding their family maybe get a little help in that area.
We're not after their money. We think they have an obligation to the people who they serve when they use the public airways every night not to lie to those people. And furthermore, I think they have an obligation beyond just not lying to them. I think they have an obligation to go out and look for the truth and to tell it honestly. And they didn't do that in this case. And there are some signs that they don't do it when their own self-interest is involved. That's wrong. The people who have these licenses ought to treat them as the sacred trust that they are. I know that sounds hokey, and that sounds maybe pie in the sky, and that's not the way business is done anymore.
But, you know, news and journalism and telling the truth on television and radio and in the newspapers didn't used to be the big business that it is now. It was something that broadcasters did because they really wanted to serve the people who let them use the airwaves. Well, you know, those days may have died with people like Bill Paley, but to lie to people, I don't think that's what that television license is for. And if we get, as Jane said, after we pay our expenses and what this has cost us, and we've had to now sell our house and we're having to move and pay enormous legal fees to make this point and to get this story out, because they made it clear to us if we started talking about this story, they would sue us for violation of the clause in our contract that said we could never talk about anything we learned while we were employed there. And that included any story like this that they chose not to air. So after we pay all these expenses, if there's a dollar or $1 million or $20 million, it's our intention that every penny of that go to help the next journalist who finds himself in a position where it's his job or the truth, and we want him or her to be able to stand up for the truth.
I really applaud what you're doing. My concern and my question, I guess, to you is that I know people, journalists like Bob Perry, who tried to tell the Iran-Contra story, people like Gary Webb, who tried to tell it again, have found themselves viciously attacked by corporate media here in the United States, and in many cases have found themselves what amounts to being blacklisted by big media and never really being able to get back into the system in the ways that they were prior to taking the risk in covering controversial stories. Do you have concerns about your future in the industry?
Yeah, I think Steve and I have pretty much decided that we will not be getting too many job offers as a result of this action. We don't expect any to be forthcoming. Once you do something like this, I think that's true. I think you're blacklisted.
I think every broadcaster who owns a television station would ask himself, geez, they might have been right, but what if I don't want to run some story down the road? God, would they threaten to take my license and to complain to the FCC about us? These people are troublemakers. They're loose cannons. They're not the kind of people we want on our staff. And, these decisions are not made by journalists anymore. They're made by bean counters. They're made by people who sell the news like they sell their refrigerators and their television sets. And it's a product to them. And why would you take a risk like this, you know, when you don't have to? There's lots of reporters who'll do what you tell them. In fact, when they threatened to fire us within 48 hours if we wouldn't broadcast their version of this story, he said to us, the general manager, look, we paid $3 billion for these television stations. The news is what we say it is. The news is what we tell you it is. And if you won't do it the way we want it done, regardless of what you think about it, we'll fire you, and I'll simply reassign it to somebody else, and they'll broadcast it the way we think it ought to be told. And I said, if you fire us for that, and you get anybody else at this television station to broadcast what we've just documented is false and inaccurate, we're going to the FCC. And 48 hours came and went, and we weren't fired, and the next thing we knew, we were back in his office being offered an amount of money that approached $200,000, and as Jane pointed out, all we had to do was simply keep our mouth shut and go away and never talk about BGH and never tell mothers and fathers what we know about what's in that milk that they're pouring on their children's cornflakes, and never tell anybody about the way that story was handled at Fox Television. That was easy money, and they figured, I suppose, that we'd take it. They didn't know us as well as they thought.
If people wanted to get more information about what was happening regarding your suit against Fox, how would they go about doing that?
www.foxbgh, standing for bovine growth hormone, suit.com. Foxbghsuit.com.
You know, it's always tough to do these kinds of stories, even when you can get them on the air, because in the end people say, gosh, I didn't know that was going on. What can I do? What can I do? I mean, these big companies are making all these decisions. I got to tell you, back when this stuff was approved 4 years ago and consumers went out and they started dumping milk in the streets and they started making it clear that this was something that they didn't want to see in their local milk supply, that got the attention of Safeway and of Vons and of Publix and of Albertsons and of the big grocery chains. And they immediately responded. They said, we hear you. We understand your concern. We will ask our dairy suppliers not to send us milk that has been gathered from cows treated with this hormone. And, you know,
they do respond. They respond whenever they think their own economic interest is at stake. And people say, what can you do? Call Safeway. Ask them if it's in the milk. If it is and you don't want it there, and that's your decision to make, you're the one drinking it, tell them so. Tell them you're going to buy your milk elsewhere if that's how you feel. If you feel a television network or a news operation is doing something that you don't agree with, write them and tell them so. There are lots of stations on the dial these days, hundreds of things you can be watching. Let them know that that's important in your decision of where to shop and what television news to watch and what television stations to watch and what commercial products that might be advertised there that you want to buy. It's not my job as a reporter to tell people to go out and start a boycott, but it is my job, I think, as a reporter, and I think every journalist's job, to get the truth out. And as you said, this is really a right to choose. And you can't make a choice unless you know what's going on. And all I'm saying is, this is what's going on. You need the information before you can make an informed choice. If you think BGH is the greatest thing since sliced bread, terrific. That's your choice to make. If, on the other hand, you say, as many people have, what is the benefit to me? The price of milk isn't going down. It's going up just like everything else. There's not a shortage of milk. God, we were paying farmers millions of tax dollars to dump milk and price supports until just recently. What is the benefit to the consumer? And I don't think it's taking a position to say that there really is no benefit to the consumer, and the risk is something that each individual has to judge. Is there smoking gun evidence that this promotes cancer? No. There is a lot of evidence that suggests that, and the evidence, I think, fair to say, is certainly persuasive enough that has caused this stuff to be banned throughout Europe. It's banned in New Zealand and Australia and several other countries. It's never been approved in Canada, despite what the regulatory officials there said was an effort by Monsanto to bribe them. They reported that to the government officials there. That wasn't just a charge. It was a documented charge that was made. So you have to decide that, but you can't make a decision unless you know. And if you think it's wrong for them to slip it by you, and if you think it's wrong for news organizations to cover it up, let them know how you feel. And on our website, you can fax some of these people for free. And let them know how you feel. That's the best advice I can give.
Jane? And let me also say, for consumers, the way that you can verify that this is your milk products come from BGH, cows that are not treated, with BGH, is to see an affidavit from the farmer or the producer that is actionable in court if it isn't true, that says that, you know, I am committed to the no BGH use, and they'll write that down if they're not using it. And then in California, you have some organic standards and third-party verification and all. And it also must come from the whole co-op, because milk is co-mingled. So the whole dairy co-op has got to be committed to this BGH-free concept. You can't just be one producer. It doesn't work that way.
And while it's important to talk about the issue of BGH here, I think it's also important for the listeners to realize, at least in my opinion, that we're talking about something that's even bigger than this, because so many people look to television news thinking, or at least hoping, that they're being told some reasonable facsimile of the truth. And while you two were courageous enough to turn down the hush money, the question is, of course, is how many reporters may have not had that level of courage and have accepted it, whether it be for Monsanto's BGH or some other corporate interest. And that, I think, is the real overarching issue here. Steve Wilson and Jane Acree, thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you.
That recording was from over a decade ago, so there is a sad and perhaps unsurprising postscript there. After years of legal battle, it turned out that they weren't whistleblowers in the eyes of the law, because whistleblowers blow the whistle on a crime, and no crime had been committed. Fox News claimed they had a First Amendment right to state their opinion, including when that was mendacious. So if they wanted to lie and distort the truth, then they had a right to do it. And this wasn't commented on, but I think this is the key point from my eyes. If they have a right to state something as a corporation, they have a right to force their employees to state it. I think that's an observation that is so much a part of people's everyday experience that they don't stop to question it. But If we're seeking to understand the universal matrix of lies, then it certainly provides an answer why, if only 1% of people are psychopathic liars, how the lies can multiply and spread. We know that corporate hierarchies are dominated by psychopaths. So, if a lot of ordinary people with consciences are towards the bottom of hierarchies, in jobs where they can't exercise those consciences, and they feel compelled to go along with plans which they've learnt they just better not question, then that certainly provides an answer as to why there is just so much lies around the place. But to return to the Fox News RBGH case, don't we have policies about this, telling companies they shouldn't be lying? Well, yes, we do, but somehow we don't have laws. And that was the finding after the Fox News legal team got to work, that whistleblowing is about breaking laws and regulations, whereas the FCC only had a policy. So if I were to say on air what a pile of sh** the FCC is, and not censor it out, then for the supposed crime of broadcasting one word, which a lot of people hear most every day, those radio stations which broadcast this show generally have a fairly small budget, liable to be hit by a fine large enough to shut them down. Whereas, the FCC only had a policy that you shouldn't lie and distort the truth. So, if Fox News want to break a policy, then they have a First Amendment right to do that. That was a legal argument, and it stuck, leaving Steve Wilson and Jane Acree with no compensation and very large expenses. They had to pay the legal bills. And unless we think that companies have a monopoly on legal loopholes that they can slither through in times of need, then we've got the following clip. Ironically enough, it's from the BBC, which makes the point that it's not just companies, it's the positions of power in the establishment. This was a section from a video entitled Ministry of Truth. This is kind of the key section because it outlines the proposition. What if politicians were answerable to the law? Just put yourself in the mind of the Member of Parliament being rung up. How quick she is with certain remarks. How can I help you? Certain things just trip off the tongue. Well, if you're not satisfied, then you shouldn't vote for the politician. Certain things just do not compute. Dishonest?
Dream with me a moment, as my alter ego makes the phone call I always wanted to make.
Hello, 8121.
Hello, is that Buck MP4?
Speaking.
Hi, this is one of your constituents.
Oh, yes?
In fact, I voted for you at the last election.
Thank you very much. How can I help?
Well, I was wondering what I can do if I think an MP has been dishonest.
Dishonest?
Yes, lied.
Oh, may I ask who?
I'd rather not say yet. I'd just like to know what my options are.
Options?
Yes, well, if a company or an individual lies to me or makes a promise they can't deliver, I can take them to court.
Yes.
Because there's an obligation to be truthful in their representations.
Well, a Member of Parliament has the same obligation.
Yes, that's what I thought, but I was wondering where it says that. I mean, there must be a law.
A law?
And if they don't abide by it, what can the electorate do?
Well, for starters, you don't vote for them, I guess.
Yeah, but we only get a vote every 4 years, and even then it's for a party.
That's democracy. You can always go to the press.
So an MP's accountability is dependent on whether it'll sell newspapers?
I didn't say that.
But you are saying there's no statute, no law that requires an MP to be honest.
Well, I need to know a little bit more about it.
Would you be interested in sponsoring such a bill?
Maybe.
You don't think we should have one?
See if I could take some details,
Mr. You're saying the electorate has to rely on its vote every 4 years for a newspaper editor to keep politicians honest. aren't you?
Is this a wind-up?
I could ask you the same question.
And that program concluded with the drafting of the Misrepresentation of the People Act, a proposed Act of Parliament in the UK, which was supported by a grand total of 37 out of 646 MPs. So I don't want to come across as pessimistic, because the world is changing. People are realizing the old ways are leading us on a path of destruction. But it doesn't seem to me we stand a lot of chance following the official channels for redress, because it always tends to be some crooked legal footwork when you get into a back room. I mean, the BBC, for example, were asked about who is Dr. Rola, can we have her full name and a few details, where is this supposed school and stuff. But when you read the small print, because it's a hybrid public authority, the BBC is not subject to the Freedom of Information Act for information which is held for the purposes of journalism, art or literature. So it was very easy for them to say, well, this is a journalistic exception. If I lived in the UK and spent any time doing FOIA requests, I might be tempted to ask them, well, how many FOIA requests have you actually received and how many have you actually granted? To make the point that the system is more for the sake of having a system than for actually providing any information. So now, to give us another angle on the interlocking nature of the lies, the fraudulent laws, fraudulent public bodies, we're going to have a former BBC journalist we've heard many times before on the show. He's a man whose quest for truth I respect and have learnt much from. This is Tony Gosling. I don't know when or where he was speaking, but this recording was posted on YouTube in June 2013.
I cut my teeth in working for the BBC in London here, Greater London Radio, in the early 1990s as a researcher on their lunchtime Johnny Walker programme and the Tommy Vance show, Drive Time show in the evening, which was really setting up that day's news. It's addictive. And then went on from there to get involved in land rights campaigning. I mean, I think this is one issue where it was right across the world. We had the land struggles here in Britain 300, 200 years ago that are going on right now in Brazil and China and other places. Sri Lanka too, where government's requisitioning land, kicking people off the land. An absolutely key issue, and which leads into a money system. Once you don't have the resources as a landowner, then you have to go in with their money system. So this is an essential, I think, understanding of why we're in such a fix with money now, is because we've been robbed of our land in this country hundreds of years ago. What I'm doing now, after that, really got it, my teeth stuck into something called the Bilderberg Group, which I'm sure many of you have heard of. I was shocked to discover that this very powerful institution, which has members which control most of the money in the Western world, was begun under the chairmanship of a former SS officer, and that's Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. And there was also a lot of connections with Bernhard in the war. He was actually given an aircraft by the Royal Air Force, and he was right at the top of British intelligence structures, involved in the planning of Operation Market Garden, where British paratroopers were dropped right into a nest of vipers of SS armoured divisions and wiped out virtually, as many people will know. So Bernhard was certainly not a character that looked like he was trustworthy to run an organisation that was supposed to be looking after our prospects for the future. Then, nowadays, I'm doing producing and presenting a radio programme in Bristol on Bristol Community FM, thisweek.org.uk. I was quite chuffed to see we got phoned up the other week from Belfast. Some people who were trying to listen had noticed half an hour before the programme that the stream wasn't working properly, so nagging our engineers to make sure it works. So there are people around the world listening, and we get comments on our forum on their blog. The website thisweek.org.uk, so you can listen to it as a podcast or live on FM if you're in Bristol.